You're listening to Radio Maria, Christian Voice in Your Home. You're now present at the show. Jesus is born of Messiah, Judaism, with Roy Shulman.
Hi, this is Roy Shulman, and welcome once again to Jesus, the Promised Messiah of Judaism, the show on Radio Maria that celebrates the Jewish roots of the Catholic Church, or seen the other way around, that celebrates the fulfillment, the completion, the full realization of all of the promise of Judaism in the Catholic Church and her sacraments. I'm very happy you're with us today. Usually the show revolves around some theme that has to do with the transformation of Judaism into the Catholic Church. But this show is going to be a little bit different. It's going to revolve around another subject of great interest to me, which is the relationship between science and the truths of the Catholic Church. And specifically, the lying myth, to tell the truth, of the society that we live in, which claims that science is against the truths of the Catholic Church. In other words, that you have a choice of believing in science, in which case you would have to dismiss the claims of the Catholic Church as medieval superstition, or you can choose to believe in the Catholic faith, in which case you have to kind of dismiss and reject the validity of science, whereas nothing could be further from the truth. I have spoken once or twice before on the show about that. And earlier this week, I was a guest on another radio show, Gary Matutis, on Virgin Most Powerful Radio, on which we discussed this issue. And so I thought that what I would do today is play a recording of that show, or at least of highlights of that show. But at the same time, be taking callers and interrupting that recording in order to answer any questions or respond to any comments that a caller might have. So even though I am nominally replaying that recording, I am here in the studio, so to speak, standing by the message board, using the message board on Skype. That's a little message to the studio, to see if we get any callers. And if we do get a caller, I'll interrupt the playback of the Gary Matutis show, on which I'm talking about the relationship between science and the Catholic faith, in order to take the call. So I guess that's really all by way of introduction. And I will say, I guess I should mention, one of the reasons for my interest in this is that, in fact, before my conversion, I went to MIT, Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and received a Bachelor of Science from there, and had a quite solid, I believe, scientific education. So it is with a, I believe, insider's viewpoint that I am indignant at the fraudulence of the claim that science contradicts the faith when really it supports the faith. The recorded show is only about 30-35 minutes. I'll take a break halfway through this show anyway for a short musical break. And if there's time at the end of the recording with Gary Matutis, I will talk about some of the other Eucharistic miracles that give a very solid material scientific proof of the truths of the faith. But with that, let me try to cue up the show and join the show a few minutes in. This is, again, this is Gary Matutis' show on Virgin Most Powerful Radio. I believe the name of the show is Hands-On Apologetics. So here we go.
So anyway, but thanks for having me on, not to talk about that today, but to talk about another very intense interest of mine, which is debunking the myth that somehow the scientific approach would run counter to the Catholic faith rather than supporting it.
Yeah, absolutely. But yeah, Roy, you know, that's an interest of mine too, because it seems like the culture, you know, the culture is very much scientifically minded, and we are influenced by the culture in lots of different ways, aren't we?
First of all, it's a little bit of a hobby horse of mine, but it uses the word scientific. In other words, I would argue that our culture is actually not scientifically minded, but there is a kind of a umbrella over our culture which claims that it's scientifically minded. And if I may kind of launch in, I want to kind of paint a little bit of the backdrop, which is I hope that your listeners all know that the entire story of life on earth between birth and death is really a battle between God and Satan for the human soul. I mean, those are the stakes, and that's what it's all about. And every human being is going to someday die, and he's going to end up in a very, very wonderful situation or in a very terrible situation. And God is, I don't want to say he's working as hard as he can, that's not really fair, but God is on one side working to bring people to heaven, and Satan is on the other side working to bring people to hell. So it's this tremendous battlefield, but when an army sets out against another army for a real physical battle, they want to choose the battlefield. In other words, you know, in the old days, it would be advantageous for an army to be on the uphill side rather than the downhill side, so the arrows could travel better or the rocks could travel better or whatever. It would be advantageous, for instance, to, you know, not be trapped between, you know, with a river to your back or whatever, so you couldn't retreat and so forth. You know, the choice of the battlefield is very important, and the setting of the battlefield is very important. And in this spiritual battle, there is an analogous battlefield, which is our culture. So, you know, although in a sense the battle is over each individual human soul, it takes place on the battlefield, and the battlefield is our culture, is our society. To use a philosophical term, is the zeitgeist, the spirit of the times, the attitude of the times. And I think the enemy has really taken over that our contemporary culture, our spirit of the times, and the way he has done it to a large part, to a large extent, is by claiming that there is something unscientific about having faith, and we are in an age of science, and you really have no right to believe something that runs against science, and science is incompatible with the faith. So if, and people absorb this, you know, and I remember grammar school, you know, you basically get this catechesis in how all of human advancement comes from science and comes from this rational view, and everything we have came from, you know, scientific discoveries and all the technology and everything, and you're throwing yourself back into the dark ages if you reject science for faith. So I think that this false accusation that somehow the faith is unscientific is really, really, really an important tool in the enemy's hands in turning us away from God.
Yeah. In fact, the whole idea that times past were dark and, you know, primitive, and that we are on this precipice of light, enlightenment, and, you know, the top of technology, it's itself kind of self-serving too.
Yes, but I'm not a Luddite. I think technology, you know, is wonderful. I'm very grateful every day for indoor plumbing, for instance, and hot running water and so forth. But the problem is that the, you know, benefits that technology have brought are ascribed to this, quote, scientific attitude, which in turn is described as being, or is considered to be contrary to the faith. And in order to make sense of the truth of the situation, I think it's necessary to consider the change in what scientific means, because, you know, the enemy also wins a lot of battles by taking over our language. We see this in the pro-choice and so forth. You know, they take over the language, they choose words carefully, they bring new meanings into words, and without noticing it, people's attitudes and, you know, opinions change as a result. And the concept of scientific and science has been hijacked, because historically, going back a couple of hundred years, science was sort of defined as, quote, worthy of belief based on objective evidence. There's nothing wrong with that. That's wonderful. You have objective evidence that's not subjective to the person, to, you know, the individual characteristics of the person seeing it necessarily, but it's objective somehow and it's worthy of belief. St. Thomas Aquinas, who I hope is kind of a bedrock of what all of us do as Catholic apologists, defined scientific knowledge in the following way. He said scientific knowledge is obtained when observable phenomena and their properties are accounted for in terms of their causes. In other words, you have observation, you have the observation of phenomena, and you have their explanations in terms of their causes. All of this is absolutely wonderful. All of this actually will support the truth of the Catholic faith, which is where, you know, I hope we get to. But rather than this historic definition of science and scientific knowledge, we have, over the last 100 years, had this kind of hijacked by a philosophy. I don't want to get too kind of deep in the weeds, but it's often referred to as logical positivism, which is essentially, and I'll read a standard definition of logical positivism, quote, a movement in Western philosophy whose central thesis is that only statements verifiable through reproducible experiments are meaningful. So you see, the definition of scientific has been shifted from worthy of belief based on objective evidence to verifiable through reproducible experiments. And what's the problem with this? The problem with this is that everything having to do with free will, whether the free will of a human being, the free will of God, the free will of an angel, or the free will of a demon, everything having to do with the free will is not arbitrarily reproducible through an experiment. Because if you ask somebody to do something, one time they may do it and one time they may not. If you ask God to do something, one time he may do it and one time he may not, and so forth. So by definition, once the ground rules have been changed to this logical positivism, it has to be subject to reproducible experiments, or else we can't consider it true. You've eliminated, actually you've by definition eliminated the miracle, the possibility of miracles. Because miracles, what are miracles? They are phenomena or actions which go beyond or contradict the natural physical laws, because they are performed by someone who can go beyond the natural physical laws, whether that's an angel or a demon or God. So with this shift in the definition of scientific, what the enemy has succeeded in doing in our culture is defining away the possibility of miracles. Not showing they don't exist, not showing that they're not worthy of belief, but essentially defining them as not possible of existing.
I'm going to cut in there just to repeat myself a little bit and underline. First of all, you're listening to a live broadcast of Jesus the Promised Messiah of Judaism on Radio Maria. And I would be very eager to take your calls here, 866-333-6279 or 866-333-MARY, M-A-R-Y. And that was pretty dense material, so let me try to do a quick flyby of it. First of all, my opening point was that the entire purpose of life on earth is to essentially determine our eternity, and God willing, leave us in the position to have an eternity of incredible bliss in the company of God. And there are, the entire life on earth is essentially a battle on a battleground. It's the battle for the human soul. There are two forces at work. They're the forces of God and the good angels who want to see us get to heaven, and they're the forces of Satan and the bad angels who want to see us lost. And this battle, of course, takes place in every individual human soul. But it also takes place on a battlefield, so to speak, to keep the metaphor going. And that battlefield is the culture. And just as when you have a battlefield, it can give an advantage to one side or another side, like in the old days, whoever had the uphill side had a tremendous advantage because whatever projectiles or arrows or stones were being thrown, of course, are easier to throw downhill than uphill. So both sides would hope that they had the uphill side of the battlefield. The battlefield today is the battlefield between Satan and God, is essentially our culture, our civilization, and the enemy has done a good job of taking over or defining the battlefield so that nowadays he has the advantageous battlefield, so to speak, because the battlefield, which is our culture, tells us that faith is somehow irrational, The great good of our era is science and technology, and that science somehow disproves the truths of the faith and disproves existence in God. So if you want to maintain your faith and if you want to preach the faith, you are, to mix metaphors, swimming upstream against the current of the culture. So the battlefield has really been taken over by this pseudoscientific worldview that says that science and the faith are incompatible. Then I go on to say that's absolutely not true. Science in its historical meaning, that you basically, you look at evidence and you, I'll give my contemporary definition of it, which is that you look at the evidence, you form a theory that can explain the evidence. If it can successfully explain the evidence, you can hold on to that theory. If it can't, you have to discard that theory. So it's basically developing principles and causal chains that make sense out of the evidence and are consistent with the evidence. However, in the last 80 or 100 years or so, this philosophy, which is called logical positivism, has emerged, which says, no, the only way you can know something is if it's subject to repeatable experimentation, and repeatable experimentation at will by anybody. So you can't think that something is true unless it's established by repeatable experiments. Now, one of the problems with this definition of what's true is that anything that has to do with the free will of an individual is not subject to repeatable experiments. You know, if you ask me to, you know, give you a dollar, maybe 9 times out of 10 I will, and 1 time out of 10 I won't. If you ask somebody to do something for you, sometimes they'll do it and sometimes they won't do it. And of course, what are miracles? Miracles are definitions. By definition, they're something done out of the free will of an individual, of a person, whether that person is God or the devil or a demon or an angel. A miracle is something that is outside of the natural order of nature because it is produced by a person who has decided at that moment to do it, and at another moment he may decide not to do it. So it's not repeatable at will. Moreover, who does the asking matters in the case of a miracle. We know this, obviously, when Padre Pio asked for something, it was done a much higher percentage of the time than when Hugh Hefner would ask for something or when I would ask for something. So the entire epistemology is the word, the entire principle of knowledge that flows from this logical positivism, that for something to be true, it has to be subject to repeatable experiments, fails by definition in the context of miracles. So what that means is our culture today basically has defined away the possibility of miracles existing. They do not succeed in disproving the existence of a miracle based on the evidence, because all of the evidence is in favor of the miracle. Instead, they basically set the ground rules to be such that whatever evidence there is insufficient to establish the truth of the miracle, because the next day you can't repeat it in a laboratory, so to speak, or the next day Joe Schmo can't repeat it. So that's basically where we got in this talk. And again, this is a live call-in show, and I am looking forward very much to calls, because this is not entirely obvious, essentially, the line of reasoning that I'm going through. But I think it's very, very important, and it very cuts very much to the root of apologetics today. In other words, cuts very much to the root of convincing people of the truths of the faith in the pushing against the prejudice of our culture to be entirely materialistic and not accept anything that's spiritual. So if you have any comments or questions, just call in 866-333-6279. And in the meantime, I will continue with the recording.
Have it made sense?
Yeah. Oh, it makes perfect sense. Like, for example, let's say I have an Uncle Fred that I never met, and I want to find out if he really is out there. So I keep writing letters. And sometimes I get a letter back, sometimes I don't. So, you know, if I want to approach it scientifically, it's not reproducible. You know, every time I write a letter, he responds.
Well, it's worse than that, actually.
Uncle Fred moved.
It's worse than that because the concept of reproducible results, they have to be reproducible by anyone. So your Uncle Fred would have to answer a letter from me.
Right. Yeah, very good. Yeah, so when you're trying to ascertain a volitional subject, someone who acts, then you can't reduce it down to a scientific score sheet where, different circumstances, they will respond the same way.
Yeah, although, see, I'm going to be a little bit pedantic. You said scientific. I don't want that word scientific to be used in a way that restricts it to logical positivism. I call that scientism, not science. Because if you define science to exclude, in a way that produces entirely circular reasoning and excludes the very family of phenomena you want to investigate, that's not scientific. That's, that is a, almost like that's a faith-based bias. That's an arbitrary stacking of the deck to produce a predetermined conclusion. So it's very unscientific.
Yeah, very good, very good. Well, we're coming up on the break. I hear the music coming up. We're talking with Roy Shulman and about science and belief and apologetics, how to share your faith in a culture that's soaked in legal positivism. Listen to Hands on Apologetics. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. That's kind of what this logical positivism kind of reduces us to, is to try to come up with some sort of mechanical thing.
Well, what it does is it takes every instance of a verifiable physical miracle. For instance, like a medical healing at Lourdes, and you have, somebody with a face eaten away by cancer who goes into the baths and come out of the baths with a perfectly healed face, and no trace of the damage. And then that's obviously a miracle. That's obviously an intervention of something outside of the physical. But that doesn't mean that you can bring 10 people with, cancer on their face to the baths. And if all 10 of them don't come out clean, the first thing never happened. That's ludicrous.
Exactly.
But that is the logical conclusion of this. It's hard to avoid technical terms, but of this epistemology, of this approach to knowing what's true, of approach to knowing knowledge. So it's I think in a way it's worse than any single example, because what it does is it's like if I went into a court case and I was defined as a liar beforehand and my accuser was defined as telling the truth, it wouldn't matter what I said, because by definition everything should be dismissed. And it's kind of like that. Everything supernatural, everything out of the physical deterministic realm gets dismissed out of hand. There's no point in going to court. You might as well stay home.
Yeah, it defines opposition out of existence.
You love and I love G.K. Chesterton because he has such a exact and penetrating and at the same time kind of humorous way of encapsulating these absurdities. So with your indulgence, let me read a quote of his about this, which is, quote, "The question of whether miracles ever occur is a question of common sense and of ordinary historical imagination, not of any final physical experiment. One may surely dismiss that quite brainless piece of pedantry which talks about the need for, quote, scientific conditions, close quote, in connection with alleged spiritual phenomena. If you choose to say, I will believe that Miss Brown called her fiancé my heart's love and desire, who I love passionately with every fiber of my being, on the condition that she will repeat the words before 17 psychologists, then I shall reply, very well, if those are your conditions, you will never get the truth, for she certainly will not say it under those conditions. It is just as unscientific to be surprised that in an unsympathetic atmosphere certain extraordinary sympathies do not arise. It is as if I said that I could not tell if there was a fog because the air was not clear enough, or if I insisted on perfect sunlight in order to see a solar eclipse. You're setting up a set of conditions that predetermine a negative outcome."
Yes, very good. So what is a miracle?
I would say that a miracle is an event in which the normal physical laws are suspended by a supernatural intervention, an intervention from the spiritual world, which is either an act of God or the act of an angel or the act of a demon. I would say, yeah, that's what I say a miracle is. By definition, a miracle is not a mechanical progression of physical events. It's coming from the outside, or else it wouldn't be a miracle. And if it's coming from the outside, it's coming from a free actor on the outside, which is why it's not subject to arbitrary reproduction.
Yeah, very good.
That's probably what a miracle is. I mean, that's, you know, when God, you know, stops a disease and reverses it, or makes the sun spin in the sky and crash to the earth, or anything else that he does. I mean, much less turn unleavened bread into the body, blood, soul, and divinity of God. That's right. That's exactly right, that it's a suspension of the physical unfolding of the what would otherwise be the physical chain of causality by an intervention from outside. Yeah. Anyway, so the other side of this coin is that given that the enemy has kind of brainwashed our culture to say that it's unscientific or, you know, it's irrational to believe in miracles, God has kind of, you know, raised the bets on the other side by, I believe, giving us an unprecedented number of physically verifiable miracles that very specifically attested the truth of the Catholic faith in our day. I think actually specifically in response to the scientific bias or the scientism bias of our culture. And we have the apparitional miracles, but maybe in a way the most physically dramatic may be the Eucharistic miracles, where a consecrated host takes on all of the physical characteristics of human tissue, of human muscle tissue, of human blood, heart muscle tissue, and also of human blood. And I know there's some of these Eucharistic miracles that date back to the Middle Ages. Probably Lanciano is the most famous, and that's from the 8th century. But I was very surprised and gratified to find out that there was a very dramatic Eucharistic miracle in 1996 in Buenos Aires, which was subjected to tremendous scientific examination and investigation and passed with flying colors as just as dramatic a Eucharistic miracle as Lanciano, in which the host turned into, you know, human flesh and human blood, and was subjected, of course, to all of today's technology to debunk it or investigate it, and it passed. And then one even more recently in 2008 in Poland, similarly subjected to tremendous physical scientific investigation and, completely supernatural and totally proven to be, so to speak. So I don't know if we have time for me to maybe briefly describe maybe that 2008 one or not, but I think they're gifts.
Well, we've got about 3 minutes.
3 minutes.
Well, I'm going to cut in once again. You're listening to Jesus, the Promised Messiah of Judaism on Radio Maria with your host, Roy Shulman. That's me. I made that a little bit of a cliffhanger on purpose. First of all, let me just, before I kind of wrap up this half of the show, say that we're going to go to a short musical break in a few moments. And after we come back from the break, the first thing I'll do is to see if there are any calls that have come in. And if there are any calls, I'll go to them before I continue with the show itself. And certainly with the recording of this show that we've been listening to. The number here is 866-333-6279 or 866-333-MARY, M-A-R-Y. Again, 866-333-6279. So if you have any inclination to call in with a question or a comment, it's always very convenient to do so during the break because, as I said, then without any interruption needed, I can just immediately go to the call. Anyway, as I was saying, I have left this as a little bit of a cliffhanger, having spent the first half of the show talking about how unscientific the pseudoscientific view that somehow science disproves miracles is, because that is entirely based on the circular reasoning that essentially miracles can't exist, so we can reject any evidence that they do exist. As I cited G.K. Chesterton having said, I'll paraphrase it, rightly or wrongly, those who believe in miracles believe in them on the basis of the evidence, and rightly or wrongly, those who do not believe in miracles refuse to believe in them on the basis of faith. In other words, a truly scientific attitude, which looks first to evidence and draws conclusions from evidence and not on the basis of a pre-existing faith, would have to admit the existence of the miraculous. And as Catholics, we have this incredible blessing of a very, very, very specific family of miracles, which are Eucharistic miracles, which not only show the power and the sovereignty and the reality of God, but actually show a very specific truth of the Catholic faith, which is that the Eucharist, once it has been confected by the priest at Mass, actually is the body, blood, soul, and divinity of our Lord Jesus Christ. And this very specific fact has been demonstrated in a number of physically verifiable Eucharistic miracles, some going back to the 8th century, but also some as recently as 10 years ago, another one about 22 years ago. And when we come back from the break, I will go into a specific discussion of those amazing recent Eucharistic miracles. So with that, let's go to our short musical break, and we'll be back in a few moments.
You're listening to Radio Maria, Christian Voice in Your Home. We're now returning to the show. Jesus the Promised Messiah of Judaism with Roy Shulman.
Hi, welcome back to Jesus the Promised Messiah of Judaism, the show on Radio Maria that celebrates the Jewish roots of the Catholic Church, or seen the other way around, that celebrates the fulfillment of Judaism, the Catholic Church, and her sacraments. Well, today I have been talking about the consistency between a truly scientific attitude and the Catholic faith, belief in the truths of the Catholic faith, and the cultural false myth that somehow they're at odds. I had been, for the first half of the show, playing excerpts from a show I did with Gary Machuda on the subject, but I've decided for the second half of the show to simply go to the source material itself and talk about, as time permits, several of these physically verifiable miracles that establish the truths of the Catholic faith. Before I launch in, again, this is a live call-in program. If you wish to call with any questions or comments, the number here is 866-333-6279 or 866-333-MARY. So the first Eucharistic miracle that I want to mention, because I very specifically I want to mention recent Eucharistic miracles that took place in our lifetime, that took place over the last 20 years or so, because they were subject to the absolute rigor of all of our scientific investigation and testing and so forth. So no one can claim that somehow, you know, they emerged from the prehistorical mists of the Middle Ages and who knows what went on and how they really came about and so forth. So let me begin with one that happened as recently as 1996. And then I will go on with one that happened even more recently in 2008. The one in 1996 happened in Buenos Aires when the bishop there actually was Bishop Bergoglio, who we now know as Pope Francis. So I'll read a short description of the miracle that I had a part in writing up. On August 18th, 1996, Father Alejandro Pezet celebrated the Mass in the church in the center of the commercial district in Buenos Aires, Argentina. He had finished distributing Holy Communion when a woman alerted him that someone had discarded a host in the back of the church. Going to the spot, the priest found the defiled host. He placed it in a little container of water that he then placed in the tabernacle of the chapel of the Blessed Sacrament. On Monday, August 26, on opening the tabernacle, he saw, to his great astonishment, that the host had become a bloody object. He informed Bishop Jorge Bergoglio, the auxiliary bishop of Cardinal Caracino and the future pope, who gave instructions to have the transformed host be professionally photographed. The photographs, taken on September 6th, clearly show that the host had become a piece of bloody flesh and had significantly grown in size. For 3 years it remained in the tabernacle, and the entire matter was kept secret. But observing that the host suffered no visible decomposition, Bishop Bergoglio decided to have it submitted to scientific analysis. In October 1999, analysis began on samples of the host. This analysis led to the declaration in 2005 by Dr. Frederick Zugiba, an expert in cardiology and forensic pathology, quote, "The analyzed material is a fragment of the heart muscle found in the wall of the left ventricle close to the valves. This muscle is responsible for the contraction of the heart. The left cardiac ventricle pumps blood to all parts of the body. The heart muscle is in an inflamed state and contains a large number of white blood cells. This indicates that the heart was alive at the time the sample was taken. I affirm that the heart was alive, since white blood cells die outside a living organism. They require a living organism to sustain them. Thus, their presence indicates that the heart was alive when the sample was taken. What is more, these white blood cells had penetrated the tissue, which further indicates that the heart had been under severe stress, as if the owner had been beaten severely about the chest." Two Australians, the journalist Mike Willacy and the lawyer Ron Tesoriero, witnessed these tests. After the doctor had submitted his findings, he was informed that the substance from which the sample had been taken dated from 1996. Dr. Zugiba then asked, "You have to explain one thing to me. If this sample came from a dead person, how could it be that while I was examining it, the cells of the sample were moving and pulsating? If the heart came from someone who died in 1996, how could it still be alive in 1999? Only then did Mike Willacy explain to Dr. Zugiba that the analyzed sample came from a consecrated host that had mysteriously been transformed into bloody human flesh. Stunned by this information, the doctor replied, "How and why can a consecrated host change its nature and become living flesh and blood? This will remain an inexplicable mystery to science, a mystery totally beyond her competence." And so ends the description, short description, of this Eucharistic miracle that took place in Buenos Aires, Argentina, in 1996. Notice a few things about this, that the doctor who examined the host, which had been transformed into heart muscle, was not aware that he was examining a miracle at all when he was given it to examine. He wasn't told that it had been a host that miraculously transformed. He was simply given the tissue and told to examine it and write a report as a forensic pathologist, which is what he was, a forensic cardiology pathologist. When he did that analysis, he noted a number of things. One is that it was very recently removed from a living body, even though he analyzed this 3 years after the miracle had taken place. It was very recently removed from a living body because the white blood cells were still alive, that the cells of the sample were actually moving and pulsating, which isn't going to last long once it's taken away from a living body. Also, that the presence of the white blood cells in the heart muscle established, I mean, not only was it clearly heart muscle that he could identify as coming from the left ventricle, etc., but the presence of the white blood cells in such numbers indicated that the heart was alive when the sample was taken, and the fact that the white blood cells had penetrated the tissue indicated that the heart had been under severe stress, as though the person had been beaten severely around the chest. Remember, at the time that the doctor wrote this report, he thought he was just examining a piece of tissue. He had no idea that this was a Eucharistic miracle. And yet, what he saw scientifically in the transformed Eucharist was very beautifully and tellingly corresponded to the story of Jesus' crucifixion. How much stronger scientific proof of the truths of the Catholic faith could you have than that? Now, as I said in the first part of the show, the answer of our pseudoscientific, logical, positivist culture would be, oh, well, if you can't repeat this experiment, we'd have no need to believe it. So basically, they're just throwing out all of the evidence, you know, all of the incontrovertible, physical, material, documented evidence in favor of the myth that they have that nothing can exist if it's not arbitrarily reproducible. Anyway, let me go on in the few minutes that I have remaining to the most recent of these Eucharistic miracles that I'm aware of that took place in Poland. Before I read the account, again, which I had a part in writing up, forgive my total inability to pronounce Polish names properly. So here is a Eucharistic miracle from 2008. In confirmation of the faith of the Church, the Lord wished to give the world a new proof of his love with another Eucharistic miracle in 2008, a miracle with features quite similar to those of the miracle of Buenos Aires. On October 12th of that year, Father Jacek Ingelowicz celebrated Mass at the Church of St. Anthony of Padua in Sokolka, Poland, in the presence of 200 people. During the distribution of communion, a host fell to the ground. Father Jacek picked it up and placed it in a small silver liturgical vessel filled with water so that the host would dissolve, and put it in a safe in the sacristy. For after a host is completely dissolved, the body of Christ is no longer present. Informed by Father Jacek, Father Stanislaw Janensko, the pastor, left the vessel in the safe for 2 weeks. He then observed that not only had the host not dissolved in the water, but a shape resembling a blood stain had appeared on it. Stunned, I did not know what to think of it, Father Stanislaw later stated. My hands were trembling when I closed the safe again. I could hardly speak. He decided to refer the matter to Archbishop Edward Ozorowski, the Metropolitan of Bialystok, the neighboring city. When the Archbishop came to Sokolka, he was shown the host, which had been placed on a corporal. On the host, he saw not only a blood stain, but something that resembled an organic material. Father Jacek pointed out that it looked like the tissue that many of us had analyzed in our biology classes. On January 5th, 2009, the bishop asked two professors of medicine at the University of Bialystok, Maria Elizabeth Sobaniak-Lotoska and Stanislaw Sulkowski, to conduct an analysis of a fragment of the host. Both of the researchers had worked in the field of histopathology for over 30 years. Father Andrei Kakariko, the chancellor of the Metropolitan Curie of Bialystok, gave each of the experts a sample of the host. The study was conducted at the university's Institute of Pathology. When the samples were removed, the fragment of the host that remained... Let me restart that sentence. When the samples were removed, the fragment of the host that remained connected to the tissue stayed closely united with the tissue to be analyzed without having lost any of its whiteness. After working separately, the two specialists arrived at the same conclusion. What they had been given came from human heart muscle that was still alive, but in agony. Professor Sulkowski stated that he observed the presence of many typical biomorphological indicators of heart muscle tissue, as well as visible damage in the form of tiny ruptures to fibers of the tissue. He added, quote, such changes can be observed only in living fibers, and they show evidence of rapid spasms of the heart muscle in the period just before death. Professor Sobaniak-Lotoska confirmed, quote, this is living heart muscle tissue. On further reflection, she was astonished at the fact that the tissue remained alive after having been separated from the organism of which it was an integral part. It was an extraordinary phenomenon, she said. As she explained, quote, The host remained submerged in water for a long time and then was left on the corporal. Therefore, the tissue should have undergone the process of drying out, but we did not observe any such changes during our tests. According to the current state of knowledge in biology, we cannot explain this phenomenon scientifically. Also very intrigued by the way the heart tissue was connected to the consecrated host, she declared that, quote, this extraordinary phenomenon of interabsorption of the heart muscle tissue with the host, observed under the microscope and also by electron microscopy, proves that no human manipulation of the sample could have taken place. In fact, the structure of the myocardial fibers and the structure of the bread were so tightly bound that no human intervention could have caused it. Moreover, the blood from the host had the same characteristics as the blood from the Shroud of Turin and the blood from the Miracle of Lanciano, that is group AB. So there you have a second Eucharistic miracle from as recently as 2008, subjected again to full scientific examination. And not only was the tissue that the host had turned into clearly heart muscle tissue that was still alive but in agony, but that the heart muscle tissue, where the host had turned into the heart muscle tissue, that transformation of host into heart muscle tissue was still there. So there was a continuous kind of a morphing of the host into the heart muscle tissue. And the host, the cells of the host, the microscopic structure of the unleavened bread kind of gradually transformed into the microscopic structure of the heart muscle so precisely and so continually and so microscopically, even under electron microscopy, that it was absolutely proof that there could have been no human manipulation, that this was a completely inexplicable from non-miraculous causes phenomenon. So we've come to the end of our hour, but I hope this show has been coherent and has been valuable to you. And it may be hard to reproduce the line of argument, but please, the next time somebody says to you, how can you believe in the truths of the faith? Don't you know about science? How can you be so unscientific? Whether you laugh openly in their face or you politely turn away and laugh behind your hand, please laugh at them, because they are the ones being totally unscientific. They are the ones going entirely on faith, the faith of atheism, the faith of agnosticism, the faith of radical materialism and logical positivism. And we, who do hold to all of the truths of the Catholic faith, have very substantial, genuine, physical, scientific proof for doing so. So with that, I just want to say goodbye. I want to extend you my prayers for a continuing rich and fruitful Lent, and I hope you join us again next week for Jesus, the Promised Messiah of Judaism on Radio Maria. Bye for now.
Hey, Sarah, I'll see you next week.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.